Okay, we're a little ahead of time, which in a way is good. So we've got one more speaker before the break. And since it's a faculty member, Dr. Steineman cannot make professors practice their talks as she makes the students do. So there's always a concern that the faculty members are going to take way more time than they've been allotted. And in fact, Chris noted that since we're 5 minutes ahead of time, could he have the 5 extra minutes? So I think I'm going to compromise. There's no way you're going to cut into our break, Chris. So I think I'm going to compromise and maybe about 2 or 2.5 extra minutes. Okay.
Thank you.
So Professor Chris Torgensen is not only a faculty in College of Forest Resources, he's also a research landscape ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. And he'll be speaking on geology, network topology, and spatial scaling of trout distributions in headwater catchments. Chris.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate those extra couple minutes. I'd like to start off by saying that I appreciate the invitation to speak today. I'm a relative newcomer here. I just arrived in March. And so this research that I'll be talking about today isn't really a part of the Water Center, but it highlights some of the things that I'm interested in some of the research that I've been doing down in Corvallis, Oregon at Oregon State University. So river networks, I think, are one of the most intuitively fascinating parts of rivers. I think we can all relate to river networks as we're flying 30,000 feet across the country or across the world for many of us. I think that our connection with networks maybe even goes back to the networks of blood flowing through our bodies. It's just this really fascinating, complex pattern that we see of drainage across the landscape. And river systems have this interesting variety, just to show a few of these network patterns. Well, network topology, or the shape and configuration of networks, has long been the topic of study for computer networks and road networks, and this is where this figure is taken from, actually, the study of networks in transportation and computer systems. So there are lots of different networks, but what I'm going to talk about today is this tree topology, or dendritic networks, those that are characteristic of river systems. Well, for most of you out there, I'm sure that you recognize the importance of networks across the landscape. It's something that we often take for granted in these river systems, that they are formed in complex networked structures, and this really does affect the biological organisms existing in these systems. And just to show a few examples, riparian buffers, of course, exhibit a strong network pattern, and then the topography itself. I mean, there's this interaction between the landscape and the rivers themselves, and I think increasingly river ecologists are starting to address how the landscape and how this network influences the biota, but it's still a relatively new field. I'm going to ask you to go down south a little bit. Our study area is Western Oregon, and what I'm going to present today is kind of a story of how we started out being interested in these networks and some of the findings that we had that were really quite surprising. First, I'd like to acknowledge the project and the Cooperative Forest Ecosystem Research Program down at Oregon State. It's actually funded by a number of different agencies, and in particular, Bob Gresswell and Doug Bateman. They're the ones that actually designed how the sampling was conducted in these many different watersheds, and they deserve a lot of credit. It was a tremendous amount of work. I came on later as a postdoc and then applied some of my landscape ecological skills to address some questions. So the organism of interest is one that I'm sure many of you are familiar with, the coastal cutthroat trout. They're common in watersheds throughout western Washington and western Oregon. And as it turns out, this species is a perfect study organism for understanding the distribution of animals or fish in watersheds and in relation to network structure. So the specific objectives were to make the analysis of spatial networks more accessible and also highlight this as a potential area for research. And then what we did is we applied some geostatistical tools, methods that aren't typically applied by river ecologists, and find a way to describe the spatial structure of fish distribution in the network. And then finally, we want to demonstrate the utility of this method for understanding these organisms and how their distribution relates to the processes of river development and geological patterns. So, to begin with, one advantage of this study is that we actually identified the entire population of isolated headwater basins for coastal cutthroat trout. This was a huge endeavor, and this map illustrates these 269 basins. So this gives us pretty strong inference if we identify the population and then we stratified these watersheds based on ecoregion and also rock type, basically hard or soft, very general. And then from that population, we selected a random sample of 40 watersheds to study in depth. And as I mentioned, this was a tremendous undertaking. We sampled the entire portion of each of these 40 watersheds of the fish-bearing portion of the stream, and then we mapped. These are fish counts, so this was a method where we used single-pass electrofishing, again, focusing on collecting data on the distribution and relative abundance rather than absolute abundance in the system. So we had this incredible wealth of information, and it was very interesting just initially because we could look at broad-scale patterns both throughout that channel network, but also at a finer scale. You can see the distribution of pools and riffles and cascades, so we could zoom in and out and raise all kinds of questions about what might be influencing these patterns. But as you can imagine, it's very complex, and we've got to find a way to reduce this complex spatial pattern to some sort of numerical model so we could compare patterns among basins in a quantitative sense rather than just qualitatively. So how do we quantify spatial pattern? I'm going to introduce you to the semivariogram. I don't expect you to understand it. It's actually very simple, and hopefully you'll come away from this recognizing that simplicity. But spatial dependence or autocorrelation is sort of the fundamental aspect that we recognize in spatial patterns. And all this means is that points that are sampled closely in space or time tend to be more similar. So this principle can be applied for describing the spatial pattern. And typically when you're calculating a semivariogram, you look at the distance between sample points, okay? So this point you might think would be more similar to this point just because they're located close to one another. Well, in a network, that's not always the case. So you kind of have to recognize that network pattern, and the Euclidean distance, that's just the straight line distance as the crow flies between two points, versus the network distance. And when you're trying to evaluate these distances between sample points in a network, you kind of need to have a computer. It gets a lot more complex, so that's where a geographical information system comes into play. So again, we're focusing on this network distance along the river pathway. So here we go, the semivariogram. I'm sure many of you didn't expect to see this beautiful equation this morning, but it's really not that complex. In common English, we could summarize this equation by half the average squared difference between pairs of points separated by a given distance. Now, don't ruminate on that too much, but what I'm trying to explain is it's really very simple. It's not complex math. What's hard is applying it. Well, once you can calculate this semivariogram, you create a representation of the semivariance, which you can think of just as the variance, the variation among points, versus separation distance. So points that are close together in space tend to have less variance. They're more similar. And as they get farther apart, they become more and more different, i.e. the variation increases, often to a point. Now, this depends on the spatial patterns in the system. You can define this distance at which the semivariogram levels off as the range. And then this maximum variation is defined as the sill. And then the nugget variation is sort of the base variation inherent in the system. That's, you know, that could be attributable to sampling error or just the fundamental variation of whatever the distribution is that you're evaluating. So these are sort of the parts, the vital parts of a variogram. You can also look at the slope of that variogram. So there are all kinds of ways that you can quantify that spatial pattern. Once again, that is why we're using a variogram. It's an abstraction of that pattern that you saw distributed, of fish distributed across the landscape, but it provides a way to sort of convert that pattern that we see with our eyes to numbers. Well, there are lots of different variograms, actually, that you can find based on the spatial distribution of organisms. You can, if you have a variogram that's just a flat line, that means there's no pattern, at least at the scale at which you sampled. That represents a random or homogeneous pattern. Then if you have a variogram that gradually increases versus separation distance, that indicates a large-scale continuous gradient. This variogram, the spherical variogram, the classic variogram that levels out at a certain distance, this indicates the presence of small-scale patchiness. And you can actually have nested heterogeneity where you've got two scales of patchiness in that system. So back to the real data. This is what a variogram looks like for this distribution. Let me go backwards. So there's the distribution. And this is the variogram that describes that distribution. Now, when we first did this, it had really never been done for fish distribution, much less on as robust a data set that we had. And the first thing is that that we noted is that this is very predictable. This was a good thing. That meant we could model it. You could actually model that equation, although that wasn't really the focus. Now, just to show you an example of what the variogram would look like if there were no spatial pattern, I took all of the numbers of fish and shuffled them throughout the network, and that's what this looks like. Okay, so that is what I mean by a random pattern, and this is a spatial pattern, or a structured spatial pattern, I should say. Well, I mentioned that we did these kinds of analyses in many different watersheds, 40 to be exact. It was a tremendous undertaking. It took 3 to 4 years to literally walk up about 200 kilometers, linear kilometers of stream. And now we have this wealth of information on all these different spatial patterns in these small headwater basins. And to show you some examples, we found all kinds of patterns, including one that appears to be random. And although this is not what you typically expect in a natural system, that the distribution of an organism is random, but in this stream, at the scale of our sampling, there was really no spatial pattern that we could tease out of this data set. We also found examples where there was just a gradual increase in counts of fish from the headwaters down stream as you approach the confluence. So here's that variogram, representing exponential or linear increase. We also found, to our surprise actually, there were some streams that showed this nested pattern. These are some simple examples. Note that the fish distribution didn't actually extend up into the tributaries. It was a very simple linear system. But again, we saw all kinds of different patterns reflected in the landscape. But what was most useful were these spherical variograms. Again, these ones that represented the described pattern in the network, and we could actually we could look at this inflection point, which I called the range, but it also represents the dominant or average scale of variation of fish distribution in that system. Now, that's kind of a hard concept to get your mind around, but just think of it as a way of thinking about the patch size, okay, so of fish distribution. If we were to just plot the linear or longitudinal profile and we kind of look at fish distribution going up and down over space, that's what I'm talking about. That's the patch size. Well, note that the patch size in Glen Creek in the Coast Range was about 1,000 meters. In the Coast Range, We also found these variograms where the inflection point appeared to be shorter. And this isn't the best example, it's a little bit noisy, but we saw this really pronounced difference between the patch size or scale of variation in these watersheds, and we thought, well, what could that be? What could cause that? And again, that really focuses on my area of interest, and that is landscape ecology, that tries to explain how these patterns in the distribution of organisms are influenced by the landscape itself. So this spatial scale of variation, this is kind of another way to visualize those patches or those clumps of fish. Just note the hot spots are in red, and the cool spots where fish are less abundant are in blue. So this is an important variable, actually, because it's important for population dynamics, understanding the patch size of the distribution of the species. It's also important for designing, sampling, and monitoring habitat for conservation purposes. Once you kind of know the spatial scale of variation inherent in a system, you can figure out how to divide up your sampling more appropriately. Again, our interest was in sort of basic research, basic science, but these are some applications of that concept in management. So the first place we looked, and it, you know, based on just sort of an obvious hypothesis, was that the patterns in the distribution of fish were influenced by geology. That's sort of, you start from the bottom and you move up, and we looked at many, many different variables, actually, to try to explain that spatial scale of variation, and we started with the geologic map, and this is where the story kind of gets interesting, because our first approach was to divide this geologic map for Western Oregon into basic rock types, sedimentary, basalt, and intrusive. You can divide those into hard and soft. And we thought, well, that makes sense. Okay, so, you know, compare sedimentary and different rock types, and different drainage networks appear in these different kinds of rock types. Although the story wasn't that simple. In fact, we couldn't find a good relationship between the geology and at least the way we classified it that way, and fish distribution. Then I came upon this interesting classification that Fred Swanson and Cindy Ricks did for the FEMAT work a while ago. They actually divided that landscape into rock erosiveness categories. So we could look at weak, intermediate, and resistant rocks, and that was actually the key. I mean, it was just sort of a different way of looking at that landscape. And then the patterns really emerged, and we found that the range, or the patch size represented here on the y-axis, when you look at the different ranges of the variograms, or the scale of dominant scale of variation, the patch size in the resistant rock watersheds was much smaller than in the watersheds with the weak rock, okay? And that's primarily because you can have hard sedimentary rock, and you can have weak. So there's a lot of variation. And that was causing this. It was sort of confounding our analysis. But again, when we divided it or used this definition of geomorphic rock type, it really helped us tease out that pattern. And then we applied just a simple multiple linear regression model based on the weak rock, which was positively correlated with the dominant scale of variation in fish distribution, and resistant rock, which was negatively correlated with the range or the predicted scale. And then we sort of qualified that by evaluating the mean distance between tributaries. So that kind of is a representation of the network structure. And we found that we could really do an amazing job at predicting that spatial scale of variation in fish distribution based on just these few variables. So I'm essentially out of time, and I'm going to just summarize the major findings. We found that the distribution of cutthroat trout was strongly spatial structured at a range of scales from 200 to 1,000 meters. And these variograms provided a relatively simple way to quantify this pattern. And it again highlighted the importance of scale of variation in understanding how trout distribution is related to landscape characteristics. And again, just in general, we have these methods. They're all developed now, and we offer them to ecologists and river ecologists so they can apply them in their own systems. And that kind of emphasizes the importance of using this software for evaluating these systems. And finally, we really need to be thinking more about the network structure in these systems. I probably don't need to remind you of that, but it's just a very important and unexplored territory. With that, thank you. Yes.
Did you look at the types of land use for part of this, or is this with respect to the land use?
Yeah, great question. The question is whether we looked at different kinds of land use. We did. We looked at all kinds of things. I mean, the first was private and public land ownership, and then we had quite a bit of forest vegetation data throughout Western Oregon. We looked at that. The problem was they're just... the relationships were too messy. That we couldn't. It was too. It was really too fundamental a explanatory variable, and that's why we kind of worked our way down, so to speak, on the landscape to the geology. Yes.
Could you describe a specific example of using this technique for urban high development?
Oh, will I provide an example of using this technique for urban hydrology? Well, that's a really interesting point because urban networks are so complex and they don't always follow this dendritic pattern. And there's a lot of theoretical work going on now in the EPA and NOAA Fisheries, actually, where they're trying to understand the statistical considerations that are necessary for applying network models in statistics. And if you have... Our method is not going to work very well if you can have two different distances between two points, if that makes sense. So in an urban drainage network, you often have this grid pattern, so you don't always have a dendritic pattern. So you could have two points that could be connected by 5 kilometers and 10 kilometers, depending upon the route that you happen to take in that drainage network. So that's the first sort of point or caveat that I would say. In an urban system, you don't have those kinds of simple dendritic networks, so it could be an issue. I could go on. It's an interesting topic. I should probably maybe cut it off there. Great question, though. Yes?
Yeah. If I understood you correctly, a weak rock was positively correlated with the higher abundance of fish.
It's positively correlated with the patch size or the spatial scale of variation in that distribution. It's not positively correlated with the numbers of fish per se, but it's positively correlated with the if you could think of it as maybe the distance or the size of the patch is probably the easiest. I can describe that to you later if you have any other questions.
Okay, so does the patch... The larger patch size, the patch that includes fish, are there the fish that are in the patch, are they more in that patch versus some other patch?
Oh, those are good questions. The question is, essentially, do certain patches have more fish than others based on geomorphic rock type? I think that's the question. And that was not the focus of this analysis. We did experiment with that, but I don't think I'm ready to talk about that yet. It's kind of complex. We can talk about it afterward. It's just that wasn't the focus of this study. Okay. Sure.
Can you comment on temporal variability of the variable branch?
Yeah, that's a great question. The question was about or regarded the temporal variability of the shape of the variegram. Well, fortunately, we had data in one of the streams, Camp Creek, tributary to the Umpqua River. And what we found is that the range, the inflection point of the variegram stayed the same year after year, even among seasons. But the height of the sill changed. So it was very interesting. What that means is that you get changes in patterns of abundance, of overall abundance, but the primary spatial scale or the basic spatial variation that occurred in the distribution of the species stayed more or less the same. And that kind of makes sense because the geology isn't changing. But great question. Thank you.
It's break time, and the next speaker will be ready to start speaking at 10:30. So be back in your seats well before then. Thank you.